many call cooking an art, but there's a lot of science in the kitchen, too. Combining disparate ingredients, heating them at a precise temperature for a precise amount of time can transform them into something totally different. So for this week's Food Fridays, Please Explain, we thought that we would look into the science of cooking. And who better to explain than Harold McGee, who wrote the Curious Cook column for the New York Times for many years and is the author of a number of books, including Keys to Good Cooking, published by Scribner, and On Food and Cooking, published by Penguin. And we are inviting you, our listeners, to call us with your questions at 212-433-9692. You can also write us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Hi, Harold.
Good afternoon, Leonard.
Most foods change their taste somewhat when they're cooked. Does cooking alter the nutritional content of foods as well?
It does, in a couple of different directions. High heat can sometimes damage nutrients, especially vitamins. But in general, what cooking does is make the nutrients and foods more available to our bodies. So it actually improves the nutritional quality.
In fact, we had somebody on our show recently who talked about the history of eating. And he said that, first people had to have really good teeth to eat the raw stuff. Then with cooking, it suddenly made food more available to children and older people as well, because it softens them. But it also breaks down their structure?
Yeah, it does a couple of things. It softens the food so it's easier to chew, and then it also damages the cells of the meat or the vegetable or the fruit. And all the good stuff, all the nourishment is inside the cells. And so if the cells are kind of broken up for us before they even get to our digestive system, then we're able to extract much more nourishment from them.
Now, what causes things like the dark brown, crispy skin on chickens and turkeys, although sometimes they don't brown in the oven? And I'm always curious about why it happens sometimes and not others. Is it because of other factors?
Well, that wonderful brown crust is the result of really complicated reactions that only happen at relatively high temperatures. And the thing about the surface of a piece of meat in the oven is that, the oven is, you've set it at a high temperature, presumably, in order to get that nice brown roasted crust. But the surface of the meat initially is wet. Because, tissues are wet. And so that water has to evaporate off before those reactions can begin to take place. What that means is that you can get a much better brown crust on a piece of meat or a chicken or something like that if you pre-dry it to get rid of that moisture so that the browning can start the moment that you put the meat in the oven. If the meat is kind of fresh out of the package, still kind of soppy, then it takes quite a while for that moisture to evaporate, and the browning only takes place at the very end.
Now, what about salting? Michael Pollan was a guest on the show last week. He talked about salting meat before you braise it. He learned that he said, use a lot of salt and do it and apply for many hours, even days in advance of cooking. Can you talk about how salt works with meat?
Yeah, in that particular case, what happens is that the salt will initially draw moisture out of the meat, but then because you're doing it over a long period of time, what happens is that salt migrates into the meat itself, and once it gets inside the meat, it does a good job or helps the meat do a better job of hanging on to moisture. So that means that when you do get around to cooking it, it's more likely that the meat will come out moist and succulent rather than dry.
So with a holiday turkey, you can get a nice crispy skin, and at the same time, the turkey, which could turn out to be dry, will be a little moister. That's why people brine their turkeys?
Well, it's true that it will make the meat itself moister, but as I just mentioned about the nice brown crust on meat, that depends on driving off water from the surface of the food. And if you brine a turkey, that ends up making it harder to get rid of the water from the skin. So So you're kind of making a compromise there. You're less likely to get a nice crisp skin, but the inside is going to be nice and moist.
Now, is all salt created equal? What's the difference between sea salt, kosher salt, iodized table salt? Is it just a matter of taste, or are certain ones better for getting certain cooking results?
Well, I guess I would say that the main difference among them is price. So they're all 99-plus percent sodium chloride. They come from different sources. Some is mined from the earth. Some is evaporated from the ocean. Some has iodine added to as a nutritional benefit. They do have slight differences among them, but when it comes to flavor, they're pretty much all the same.
Well, it seems to me some sea salts do taste a little sweeter than other salts.
Well, when people have gone into the laboratory and conducted taste panels where people don't know which salt it is that they're tasting and ask them to judge things like that, the complexity of flavor, sweetness, and so on, what they find is that people can't tell the difference. And so I think it has to do with the expectations we have, the associations we have with certain kinds of foods. And we just I think, romanticize what it is that sea salt is, and therefore we talk ourselves into thinking that it tastes different.
And we see that with all sorts of tests, like the ones they did with wines where they tell people.
Yeah, that's right. If you have expectations for a food, whether it's wine or salt or anything else, it'll affect the way you experience it.
So, some of the first preserved foods were salted. How does salt preserve foods and keep them from spoiling?
Well, it makes it difficult for the microbes that spoil foods to grow on those foods. So essentially what you do when you salt a food is that you extract much of its moisture, make it drier, relatively speaking, than it was fresh. And also the salt concentration in the food and on the surface of the food is so high that very, very few microorganisms can grow. And so the result is the food doesn't spoil.
My guest is Harold McGee, and we're talking about food science. He wrote the Curious Cook column for the New York Times, author of a number of books, including Keys to Good Cooking, which is published by Scribner, and On Food and Cooking, which was published by Penguin. Our number here is 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org. How can we get a good sear on scallops or on steak, for example? And does searing really seal in juices, as many cookbooks have suggested?
Well, searing does not seal in the juices. That's an idea that actually came not from a cook, but from a chemist back in the 19th century, and it turned out he was completely wrong, even though he was a chemist.
And yet you still read it in cookbooks.
Yeah, that's right. I've spent the last 30 or 40 years trying to convince people that it's not true by doing demonstrations and so on. And still, you see it on TV and in magazines. So I think it's like a vampire. You know, you just can't kill it. The way to get a good sear, which, by the way, you want to do not to seal in juices, but for the flavor, the wonderful flavor that the searing produces, it's essentially the same thing as we were talking about earlier with meat in the oven. You want to get those high temperature reactions going as soon as possible. And so what that means is that you want the pan to be nice and hot to begin with, and then you want to dry off the surface of the food so that the water will evaporate quickly and the temperature will go up very quickly. Scallops and things like that are a challenge because, of course, they're very moist. You look at them and they leak fluids. So what you want to do is pat them dry just before they go into the pan, and then you'll get a good sear.
Now, another thing that cookbooks have told us over the years is if you're cooking a piece of beef, you should cook it completely on one side and then flip it to the other side. More recently, I've heard that it might be a better idea to move them back and forth again and again. Is there any scientific justification for either approach?
Yes. In fact, that was an experiment that I did back in the late 1990s on a computer to begin with, because it was easier to see what was going on that way and then go ahead into the kitchen and do the experiment. It turns out that the more often you flip a piece of meat on the grill or in the frying pan, the faster it cooks through and the more evenly it cooks through. And that goes down to, you know, every 10 or 15 seconds, if you can talk yourself into doing that. You end up with a much more evenly done piece of meat, and it takes, for example, a one-inch thick steak might take 12 or 13 minutes to do on the grill or in a frying pan. If you flip it every 15 seconds, the time goes down to about 7 minutes, so you save almost half the time.
Although, if you're doing a hamburger, you have to hope that it won't fall apart each time you flip it.
That's right. I don't recommend this at all for hamburgers, because you're right, they would just completely disintegrate. I discovered that the hard way.
Another thing we're told is to rest meat after you've cooked it. Is that scientifically a good idea?
It is, because when you take the meat off the heat, it's very hot, and also the temperature is still changing. The outside is still hotter than the inside, so the meat is still cooking through. What you want to do is let it cool down so that the heat becomes distributed more evenly, and then as it cools down, it turns out that the meat tissue can partly reabsorb some of the juices that have been freed up by the cooking. And that means when you cut into it, rather than the juices just running all over the plate, they'll stay in the meat and make that bite of meat much juicier.
Is it advisable to cut into the meat to see if it's done while it's still cooking?
Well, it's fine to do that. It does leave, you know, a little wound in the meat, and if presentation is important to you, you might not want to do that. But the idea that cutting into the meat is going to, you know, remove a lot of the juices and make it drier, that's just not the case. So it doesn't hurt.
When you marinate meat, how does it absorb those flavors? Don't marinades just go into the very top layer of cells?
Yes, that's right. Marinades flavor just the surface of the meat, unless you leave the meat in the marinade for days and days and days, in which case the outside is still going to end up much more intensely flavored than the inside.
So the whole idea of marinating meat to get a lot of flavor inside, that is just another one of our fantasies?
Yeah, it's a fantasy, although, you know, if you can flavor the outside of the meat, because every piece of meat that you cut is going to have a little bit of the surface and a little bit of the inside, you do, the inside ends up getting flavored, but not till it gets into your mouth.
So what are other ways to tenderize the meat?
One good way to tenderize meat, if you have the time, is to age it, because it turns out that the meat's own enzymes will very slowly break down the connective tissue that can make it tough, and that will tenderize it. That's why dry-aged beef is so prized and so expensive. That's really the best way.
But, of course, people who have kosher diets can't do that.
Right, yeah.
So how do you age meat without having it go bad?
You do it in a relatively cool place. Refrigerator is actually a little bit too cold for aging to take place, because those enzymes need some heat, some energy to do their job. So the ideal temperature is in the upper 40 degrees range, which is a little warmer than most of our refrigerators are.
My guest is Harold McGee. He wrote the Curious Cook column for the New York Times for many years. He's the author of a number of books. Keys to Good Cooking is published by Scribner. On Food and Cooking is published by Penguin. There was also, Food Science? What were some of the other books?
Let's see. The Curious Cook, Keys to Good Cooking, On Food and Cooking. On Food and Cooking is the one that's used in culinary schools as a textbook.
And we will be taking your calls at 212-433-9692 after we take a little break. Stay with us for more. And we're back with Harold McGee on today's Please Explain look at the science of cooking. We invite your calls at 212-433-9692, or you can write us on our show page at WNYC.org, on Facebook, or on Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. A listener asked about Michael, in fact, from the East Village, what happens chemically when you caramelize onions and garlic?
So caramelization is what happens in vegetables and sugar-rich things that's comparable to the browning that we were talking about on meats. So caramelization is a high-temperature reaction that converts the sugars in a food into lots and lots of flavorful compounds and colored compounds. That's why they turn brown. And so what happens when you cook onions and garlic is that the sugars in those vegetables are, many of them are bound up in aggregates that aren't that sweet, but the heat breaks those down and releases the sugars so that we sense that sweetness much more completely. And then those sugars are caramelized and generate those sort of rich, brown, delicious aromas.
And similar things happen when we roast vegetables like beets, squash, even Brussels sprouts?
Exactly. All of those things have at least trace amounts of sugars and sometimes more than trace amounts, and that's where those flavors come from.
Now, garlic seems to change a lot more than most things when it's cooked. Can you explain what happens when it's cooked, when it's baked, for instance?
Well, so garlic is much easier to overcook than onions are because garlic actually contains much less water, which means that it dries out faster and it's much easier to scorch. And then it's also very rich in sulfur compounds, the things that make it pungent. And those compounds, when heated too far, can generate byproducts that are sort of acrid and bitter and unpleasant. So that's why you need to be more careful.
So if you overcook it, it can become bitter. But if you cook it just right, it's fabulous.
That's right. And baking is the best way to make sure that you don't overdo it, because baking is a gentler, slower process than sautéing.
Let's take some calls. Our number 212-433-9692. Michael, hi, you're on the air.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
I was just curious if Harold McGee could mention something about the sous vide method of cooking and if there was any food safety risk associated with it.
Okay, so sous vide cooking is essentially cooking at low temperatures. It's cooking meats in particular at the temperature that you want the meat to be at when it's perfectly done. If you cook in an oven or in a frying pan, the cooking temperatures are much higher. And in sous vide cooking, you cook the meat at the temperature you want it to reach. So that's maybe 140, 150, 160 degrees.
And why? So why did city health inspectors give so many restaurants a hard time?
Well, it's because if you don't do it pretty carefully, you can end up with the meat sitting at temperatures low enough for bacteria still to grow. And that means that you could end up with food poisoning. So, but it turns out that once people looked at it in thoroughly and in the context of cooking in general, that's true of lots of techniques that we use in the kitchen. So we just needed to make it clear to people who do sous vide cooking that you have to follow a few very straightforward rules, and then that's not an issue at all.
Is it possible to do it at home, or does it require special professional equipment?
No, you can do it at home. It's a little bit more of a pain to do it without a kind of automatic heating element that keeps the temperature just right. But what you can do, for example, is put the food in a plastic bag, seal up the bag, one Ziploc bag, that kind of thing, and then plop it in a big pot of water. that has been heated to the temperature that you want. So if you want, say, a medium rare steak, you want it at about 140 degrees, you use a thermometer, get the water to 140 degrees, put the meat in, and then every 5 minutes or so, come back and check the temperature to make sure that it's close to 140. If it's dropped below that, then add some hot water to bring it back up. And that's essentially all that sous vide cooking is.
What is it about braising that makes meat so tender, so that it can even fall off the bone?
Well, in fact, braising is kind of the closest traditional method of cooking meat that we have to sous vide cooking, because braising is cooking in a low oven, so the heat is low, over a very long time, and that long time of cooking gives the connective tissue in the meat time to dissolve away, turn into gelatin, and that gelatin is what gives braised meat its wonderful moist succulence.
So is it better to use braising for tough cuts of meat?
Yes, exactly. If it's a tender cut of meat, then in fact braising is like any other technique. You use it only as long as it takes to get to the meat to the right doneness, and then you stop because you don't want to go any further than that. But if it's a tough cut, lots of connective tissue, that connective tissue takes time to dissolve.
John from Bergen County, hi, you're on the air.
Good morning, Linus. Good afternoon. Sometimes we buy steak and we put it in the freezer, and we then defrost it later on. We find that the flavor is not the same as this that cooked the meat fresh from the store. Am I correct in that assumption?
Yes.
That defrosted steak doesn't taste as well as steak we buy fresh and don't freeze?
Yeah, no, that's quite right. If you buy a piece of meat and freeze it, then a couple of things happen. One is that the structure of the meat, the cellular structure, is damaged because the formation of ice when you do the freezing forms little crystals with sharp edges that kind of puncture the cell walls. And so when you thaw the meat, a lot of the juices come off before you even begin to cook it. And then those low temperatures and a long time of storage does cause some of the fat molecules in particular to change, and that gives a different kind of stale flavor to the meat.
Thank you.
A listener says it is possible to have aged kosher beef. It's available in her local butcher shop. I didn't know that, but I'm glad to hear it. What about ceviche? It cooks without cooking. How does that work?
Well, ceviche is used with fish and shellfish, and it essentially involves cutting the fish or shellfish into small pieces and then immersing it or dousing it with a very acidic solution, usually lime juice. And what happens is that the acid in that juice denatures the proteins, changes the structure of the proteins in the meat, in the fish or the shellfish, in pretty much the same way that heat does. And so the fish or shellfish turns white the way it does when you cook it, and the texture firms up, and you end up, as you say, with something that seems cooked but hasn't been.
Has cured meat like salami or prosciutto been cooked?
It depends on the particular kind of meat preparation you're talking about, but those two are usually not. So meats can be cured by the use of salt and nitrates or nitrites. And again, time is very important in all this, which the combination of the salt, the concentration, the nitrites, and time changes the structure of the meat in such a way that it develops a wonderful texture and flavor.
And is safe to eat.
Yes.
Even though it hasn't been cooked. Now, I've heard that when you're sautéing in oil, you should wait until the oil is smoking before you add the other ingredients. Otherwise, they'll absorb the oil. Is that true?
Well, no. It depends on the food. For example, a piece of meat is not going to absorb any oil, although a mushroom or a piece of eggplant will, because they're porous. But you should also be careful, I would say, not to get the oil to the smoke point, unless you're really trying to cook the heck out of whatever it is you're cooking, because that smoking means that the oil is actually breaking down, and you're going to end up with, again, kind of acrid, unpleasant flavors as a result.
Well, of course, you have deep frying, and that cooks very quickly, doesn't it? But the problem is that a lot of the oil remains in the food.
Yeah, it remains on the surface. But the great thing about deep frying is, well, a couple of things. One is the flavors that you get are just like nothing else. That has to do with the reaction of the oil with the surface of the meat. A second thing is that it cooks very quickly because you've got this high temperature coming at the food from all sides. The food is immersed in the hot oil. And then it turns out that scientists have looked at this very carefully, trying to figure out how to minimize the amount of oil left in the food. And it turns out that most of the oil gets into the food not during the cooking, but after you take it out, when the food stops emitting steam and things can then begin to percolate back into the crust. So the best way to keep as much oil as possible out of the food is to take it out of the oil, shake it, to shake as much of the oil off the surface as you can, and then immediately blot it.
Now, egg yolks seem to me to be the almost universal food emulsifier, but when you have just a little bit of yolk or a little oil in egg whites, then you can't whip them.
That's right, and that's because when you're whipping egg whites to make a foam for a souffle or meringue or something like that, you actually don't want to emulsify. You want to denature the proteins and get them to solidify around the bubbles of air that you've introduced in the beating. And it turns out that oil and egg yolk, which of course is rich in oil, will interfere with the formation of those bubbles and the bonding of the proteins to each other. So you end up with not much of a foam at all.
Some beaten egg whites call for cream of tartar. Why?
That's because the cream of tartar, which is an acid, changes the behavior of those proteins and makes them more stably bonded to each other. It takes longer to make the foam with cream of tartar, but once you make the foam, it's much more stable than it would be otherwise.
Now, I've heard that some vegan recipes call for vinegar to replace eggs. Why would that work?
I don't think it would. I've never seen that, and I don't know what how it could possibly, because vinegar is a very acidic liquid, and eggs are very rich in proteins and fats and solidify, so I just don't see how they're interchangeable.
One listener suggests using yogurt to tenderize meat. Is that a good idea?
Well, yogurt is acidic, and acids will, to some degree, tenderize meats. But again, it's only going to happen at the very surface of the meat.
Now, some people suggest putting vinegar in the water when you poach eggs. Is that a good idea?
You do see that in a lot of cookbooks, and I would say it's a bad idea. The reason for that is that the vinegar does cause the proteins to coagulate faster, but what that means is you end up with a lot of streamers, a lot of kind of junk floating around in the water around the egg. So, in fact, the best way to get a nice poached egg is to crack it into a slotted spoon and drain off the really thin egg white.
And
then,
Harold,
when you poach it,
we have to leave it there because we've run out of time. Thank you so much for being on today's Please Explain. The books include Keys to Good Cooking and On Food and Cooking. It's been a pleasure having you on our show.